Accession number 27347, Reel 3.
Stanley Mann, Reel 3. Obviously, while you were working at ICI, the war had started, and have you any early memories of that period, really, which was the phony war, when many of the restrictions were brought in?
Everything we did... Sorry, everything that wasn't done would be accompanied by the statement, oh, but don't you know there's a war on? And there were lots of things that didn't appear. If your work's bus didn't turn up, don't you know there's a war on? If the rations weren't there, don't you know there's a war on? If you asked for a set of batteries for your torch, don't you know there's a war on? Every shortage was accompanied by, don't you know there's a war on? Of course we knew there was a war on. We were sick of hearing about it. But the war wasn't hitting us very much in those... Where the war was hitting us was worry about our families, worry about my brother who was away in France and in Dunkirk. And I remember... my brother was with the retreating forces into Dunkirk, and he lost his officers. By that time he was a staff sergeant, I think, and he attached himself and his men to a guard's unit that was retreating and destroying bridges and destroying vehicles as they went. And because he was with ordnance, he was spiking guns and so on. They were blowing things up, and breaking up rifles and blowing up ammunition, so that he was behind in Dunkirk after Churchill said we'd got out so many thousand men. We still hadn't heard from my brother. And he came out, I think it was three nights after we were told by the newspapers that we'd got everybody out. He came out three nights later in HMS Shikari, which was a destroyer that patrolled up and down the coast looking for stragglers. And that night
was about the time of Dunkirk that the Home Guard was formed. Is that when you joined?
That's when I joined the Home Guard, yes. My first job, I joined at 16 and a bit, but they weren't very interested in taking your age. You were supposed to be 18, I think, or 17, but I was underage. My first job was stripping electric wire out of lead encased wire to get the copper wire, and I was binding First World War bayonets onto broom shanks, because we had nothing else. As time went on, we did very well. I was with because my pal Ken Walker, his father was a signalman.
So am I right in thinking that you really joined at the stage when it was still the local defence volunteers rather than the
Home Guard? No, I was too young, they wouldn't have me then. My pal's father was a signalman, and he was a sergeant in the railway platoon, and I eventually got in through him. So I was with the railway platoon, which was very interesting because we had to get to know every signal and every point so that we could sabotage if Jerry came in. And we were going to sabotaged the swing bridge at the entrance to Middlesbrough Docks. So we had to learn how to run a locomotive and trucks against points which we would set against them to derail them in the appropriate places. It was a very interesting experience. I learned so much about railway operations. We were going to sabotage. We got steel plates rejects from Smith's Docks. If they punched holes in a plate for the rivets and had them in the wrong place, it was a reject. If they could crop it, they would and have a smaller plate. But there were many plates that they rejected, and we scrounged some of these, and we lined a truck with steel plates, so we had armoured trucks, and we were going to drive the locomotives so they could shoot at us with the armoured truck, and we were going to smash up the swing bridge. The marshalling yards at Middlesbrough, we had it all planned out where to have two trains meet head on. It was interesting. To a boy, this was the it was like reading the Beano and the Hotspur and the Rover and the Wizard.
You said there was very little equipment at the start when you joined.
None at all. None at all. It had all been left at Dunkirk.
So, when would you drill, and what would you drill with?
Well, there was a lot of waste of time in that we did a lot of arms drill with a broom shank. I mean, to slope arms was absolutely unnecessary. How to salute an officer and all the rest of it was a waste of time, except that it was an acceptance of discipline, and it was the first discipline some youngsters ever learned. It got us into the atmosphere of doing things when we were shouted at, which would have been necessary under active conditions. We were conditioned, and we were conditioned by people who'd been in the First World War and were in reserved occupation.
What was the makeup of the unit?
Oh, they were all railway men, and they were all men who'd been junior NCOs during the First World War, anything from lance corporals up to sergeant major. We had a captain in charge of the platoon. I'm trying to think what his experience had been. He was a First World War man. I can't remember what he'd been.
And did your uniform arrive slowly, or did
we? It came in pieces. It came as an armband, first of all. The need for it, of course, was that if a civilian bore arms against an occupying force, you could be shot out of hand. Just to have an armband, whether it would have been recognised by Jerry or not, I think he would have still shot us out of hand. Because of the shortage of rifles and ammunition, as a chemist, I was trying other things. I was clearing out a cupboard at ICI and found a bottle, about a litre bottle, which was filled with yellow phosphorus immersed in paraffin. I didn't know what the hell to do with it, so I'd put it back amongst the cobwebs. But my friend who'd been in the Spanish Civil War told me about Molotov cocktails, and they were trying to get us to put a rag in the neck of the bottle filled with anything inflammable and strike a match and light it. And it came to me suddenly, oh, I could do that without having a match. So I pinched this bottle of phosphorus, and we took 7 ounce bottles, put originally we tried with paraffin, and of course it didn't work. Eventually somebody gave up a gallon of his petrol ration, and we filled the bottle with petrol and popped in a piece about the size of a hazelnut of phosphorus, and put a crown cork on it, and we'd got one of the fitters to machine a taper, which we went over the top and you banged it, and that crimped the crown cork, and then you threw this at a stone or we had a brick wall we threw it against, and for about 20 seconds it didn't ignite, and then it ignited because the phosphorus was exposed to the air. And so we went to town making Molotov cocktails. I had 24 of those under the floorboards in my bedroom. Dad would have had fits if he'd known. He did have fits when I eventually told him, when I was going in the forces and had to get rid of them. There were lots of other things with it by that time, because I'd graduated to be Lance Corporal, in charge of a Lewis gun. And the Lewis gun pans held 28 rounds, but firing a Lewis gun, it was too fast for anybody to count them. So I always pocketed at least one round out of a pan, and I had something like 300 rounds of ammunition under my floorboards. My pal Ken Walker and myself were going to sell ourselves dearly if the time came.
Gradually then, did your weapons arrive?
Yes, mainly American weapons, the Ross rifles, which had different ammunition to ours, of course. The 303 rounds wouldn't fit a 300 bore. In addition, the Enfield had a flange on the end of the cartridge case, whereas the Ross rifles had a groove with a detent that clutched it. So originally I had something like 20 rounds of Lee Enfield, but I got rid of those on the range and replaced them with the 300, which I got from the American machine gun that we got, and the Ross rifles we had. So all the ammunition under my floorboard was the American style, 300 round.
Where did you do your shooting?
In the Eston Hills. We had a range there that had been used from, Napoleonic times as an army shooting range. And we used to fly the red flag from the pole on the top of Eston Hills.
And initially you said it was the Ross rifles that had arrived.
Yes. Originally, there were about two rifles, two Lee Enfield rifles came through. Where they came from, I don't know. Probably people who came back from Dunkirk and brought them with them. But the official supply was all American. There were the Ross rifles and the American-style Lewis gun that fired the Ross ammunition as well.
Had you done any shooting prior to this period?
I'd shot from my earliest days with a .177 Diana air rifle, air gun, smoothbore air gun first of all, and then a rifled one. Every time I went down to my grandmother's in Sussex, and how I got there is quite a story too. She had a Diana air rifle for keeping the pigeons away from her broad beans and peas, and she used to lean out of her bedroom window and shoot at them. But I used to borrow this and I'd go rabbit hunting. Granny used to insist that I never shot anything except for the pot. If I shot it, I had to eat it. Because she'd gone out to Canada with my uncles after the First World War on the land allocation scheme, and they'd been landed in September on a plot of land with four pegs in the ground, and the uncles had made a dugout. They picked berries and they lived off rabbit and berries right through that first winter. Granny was a frontiers woman. Anyway, yes, I'd shot from being a youngster, and the uncle who got the military cross did everything he could to help me with the shooting.
What type of instruction did you get from the Home Guard then with shooting?
Oh, it was mainly from the old hands from the First World War. In particular, I remember my friend's father, who'd been a sergeant, and he was very good at instructing. He wouldn't stand any side interest. We had to concentrate on what we were doing. With the Lewis gun, he taught me how to strip it down, identify every part by feel in the dark, and to reassemble it in the dark. Every form of stoppage. I'm not sure how much of it came from his First World War experience and how much he'd refreshed himself with instruction books on the Lewis gun. I remember he had got books from somewhere, and there were few and far between any printed matter on rifles, explosives, machine gun was few and far between. Very difficult to get hold of any.
When you shoot in a rifle or a Lewis gun, what are the principles that you have to remember to hit the target?
Oh dear. Main thing was the mounting for the Lewis gun, or with a rifle, the way you held it, and the way you angled your body so that you could hold the rifle steady. Holding it steady was the first thing. Using your sights properly was terribly important, and the thing that a lot of people never seem to cotton on to. Estimating the range was the most difficult thing, and setting your rear sight according to the range at which you were shooting. Allowing for wind was another thing that was purely certain experience, they couldn't really teach you much about that. There were rules of thumb that we were given, which sometimes applied and sometimes didn't. But generally, we were mopping up anything we were told because we realised our lives might depend on it, hoping it wouldn't.
How good a shot were you, would you say?
I was pretty good. We always had a sweepstake. I mean, that was the thing, I think, that was encouraging people to look for accuracy. And I very often cleared the sweepstake. Mainly, I think, because from the age of about 7, this uncle had taught me how to shoot. And in Granny's garden, there was an old gate that led into the field behind, and it had a chain and padlock on that never came off in my memory. But the oak had cracked along the top, and I remember my uncle putting pennies in the crack and going back 5 yards, 10 yards, 15 yards, 25 yards, can you hit the penny? And going back until I was getting better at it. And anything that I hit, providing I could find it, was mine.
And as a Lewis gunner, did you operate singly or with somebody else?
Always in a team, on the principle that as a Lewis gun man, you'd be the prime target for anybody with a Tommy gun. And you probably wouldn't live very long, so you had to have henchmen who were capable of rolling over, clearing a stoppage and getting going again, and not just one but two or three.
Would they carry the ammunition?
Oh yes, they carried the pans. We used to always load up the pans as far as we had them, but pans was scarce. And not easily made either. So we had men who would take an empty pan and be loading it while you were firing the next pan.
Where would they carry the ammunition?
Oh, generally they had a haversack. They'd carry it in anything they'd got. Most of the railway men had a haversack that they used to take their bait, their lunch in, and mostly you'd get about four pans, I should say, into one of these haversacks, and it was as heavy as you could carry because it did have 108 rounds with four panniers. It was as much as anybody could carry.
And what was the reasons for stoppages when you were firing the gun?
Oh, grit, dust, dirt, heating, ammunition which was oversized, or damaged flanges which couldn't eject, or faults on the gun as well. The claws which engaged on the extractor part of the casing might get worn or get bent, and then of course the gun just seized up.
How would you clear a seizure?
We had certain actions where you could. One was to knock on the side of the pan, which would give a sideways thrust to the incoming round, which would help work the mechanism on the extractor to get the previous one out. That's as far as I remember. But we had a number one stoppage, a number two stoppage, a number three stoppage with certain action. I forget them. But I must tell you about the fact that we had the Dorman Long blast furnaces when it came to discharging the steel, the iron ore, all the dross, all the slag had to be poured out first, and this had to be done when it had to be done. They couldn't put it off, they couldn't wait till morning, and it was done at night, and we used to light up the whole sky with this. And Jerry learned that if he sent an intruder over, at the time they were tapping, he could do a lot of damage. If he could drop a bomb anywhere near the furnace that was discharging. So we were very keen to have our Lewis gun mounted for anti-aircraft work, and I indented for an anti-aircraft mounting for the gun, but I was told that they were unlikely to be available in the foreseeable future. But if you selected a tall home guardsman, made sure that he had the strap of his steel helmet as tight as possible, you could rest the forelegs of the Lewis gun on the brim of his steel helmet, and with his height you could fire at aircraft. Well, I've never heard such a bloody stupid thing. The vibration of it meant that the legs would come off and he'd get get the muzzle of the Lewis gun in his ears. And the state of dentistry in those days, a lot of people would never go near a dentist. It would rattle the teeth out of him. So I got the boys looking everywhere for bedsteads. You know the angle iron on the side of a bedstead? We got about 6 foot 6 lengths of this. And with a lot of hand drilling and nuts and bolts, and I got some welding done too. We made stands. And then at Dorman Long's they seemed to get organised, and they had all the furnace tappings during the day and none at night. Law of cussedness. Anyway, I did on two occasions get a shot at aircraft, but I think I frightened myself more than I frightened them.
What kind of height were the aircraft flying at?
Oh, they must have been coming in at about 800 or 900 feet, something like that. They were below 1,000 anyway, on the run into Dorman Long's, which was, it was about 2 miles away. 2 miles away.
How easy would it have been to hit a moving aircraft with the Lewis gun?
Well, chucking a whole pan at him, 28 rounds, your chances were pretty small of hitting something worthwhile.